This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
I'm Sharmila Ganesan, and welcome to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture. This is an 8-part mini-series that aims to delve into key aspects of Malaysian history. So today, we will be taking a look back at the historical impact of the Portuguese and the Dutch in the Malay Peninsula, and with a particular focus on the communities that they built and the continued legacies today. And to join me in this conversation, I have with me Sheila Da Costa, who is president of the Selangor and Federal Territory Eurasian Association, as well as Dennis DeWitt, who is an independent historian. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Sharmila.
We love being here.
So Sheila, you know, let's begin with the Portuguese, right? And I mean, the thing we all learn in history, they conquered Malacca in 1511. Maybe you can set up a little bit on why did the Portuguese want to take over Malacca? What was it that they were hoping to gain from having a presence here?
Okay, I think everybody thinks of conquering and things like that. I think initially the main reason was actually trade. I think everybody doesn't want to come and fight. I think most people would come and see whether they can, you know, look for better opportunities, which we even do in the current day. So I think the main reason for the first part was to come in to do to trade. Mm-hmm. And because of certain incidences which occurred, which meant bringing ships with fighting men in, I think in the end, that was what happened. They took over Malacca, yes. Mm.
To what extent did the Portuguese sort of build the city, build on what was already existing in terms of the culture, the economy, the social foundation, rather than sort of starting completely anew?
I think Malacca was actually a very busy port at that time. It was like a confluence where I think people from China, India, and the various parts came to trade. And so what they did was they built upon it, obviously took over and did the administration, maybe did it in a different way, opened some hospitals and things like that. But it was, I think, trade mainly, yes. Mm.
So their focus was not so much on creating infrastructure for its own sort of a cultural sort of presence. It's whatever served the trade aspect of it.
I think humans in general, I mean, if you go by it, are actually very selfish people. We all look to helping ourselves first. So I think, I don't think they came out with the thoughts, oh, let's go and promote. I think they just wanted to better themselves, and because there was a lot of things going on in Europe and they were like at the edge of everything. So it was probably easier for them to go out to, and not to mention at that time, the leaders that they themselves had, like Prince Henry the Navigator, things like that, who encouraged it. So it's all also about the leaders you have. Mm. Yes. And I think that was what encouraged them to go out.
Yeah, I think something to add on that. I think we humans have this necessity, this drive in us to go forward. Okay, we've seen this many times before in our history, whether it's going to the moon or beyond even. So I think this kind of concept existed in the minds of the people from those days. So that's why they were great adventurers. And of course, the Portuguese had taken the lead on this. And of course, we understand that the Portuguese also worked around the idea of the 3Gs, right? Not the 4Gs in the phone, or 5Gs coming up. So it's for God, goal and glory. Mm. So first of all, I think they have to use religion as an excuse, definitely, to come to the East, to spread the religion. For goal, definitely, for trade, and for glory of the country. Mm. So the Portuguese came under the auspices of their king.
So that's interesting, right? Because this idea of glory, I would think, would be tied to the idea of legacy. However, today, very little of that original infrastructure, the physical infrastructure of the Portuguese city of Malacca is actually around, right? I mean, we have the foundations of the fortress walls, we have parts of St. Paul's Church. But actually, when you think about it, it's relatively little that remains. Why is that so?
Okay, if you think about it, one civilization always seeks to destroy the one that came previously. And I think this is part of history. And so I think the Dutch and the Portuguese were not. So things get destroyed. And also whether there was this thing about trying to retain everything, because I think when the Dutch came, there was a they were of a different Christian denomination. So they possibly wanted to destroy the so-called Catholic or Papist, culture. So I think it usually is the case that if the conquering heroes always tried to erase the previous regime.
Mm. Actually, Sheila, I disagree with that. No?
Okay. I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, of course. Hear that too.
Well, when the Dutch captured Malacca, as you know, the history tells us, it was a very bitter fight. There have been several attempts to capture Malacca from the Portuguese, but the big one came in 1640. And there was a siege for about 6 months in Malacca at that time between the Portuguese, who were defending the fortress, and the Dutch, who were trying to capture Malacca with the help of the people from Johor. So during that 6 months, there was a lot of bitter fighting. So much so that a lot of what was left in Malacca from the Portuguese era was destroyed. So most of the buildings that the Dutch found out after they took over Malacca, most of the buildings were rendered useless. So it wasn't, I think, the intention of the Dutch at that time, record states, that they wanted to destroy or erase what was left behind by the Portuguese. But it was inevitable because of war and the battle that occurred in Malacca. So,
you're
that's
suggesting
the main why.
That there may not have been that sort of overt religious agenda?
No, there wasn't. To the Dutch, it was very simple. It was about trade and friendship. Friendship mainly with the locals, with the Malays.
Mm. Is there anything that you want to add, Sheila, before we move on?
Yes, war generally destroys things anyway. So that would have happened, you know, inevitably. But yes, he could be right. But also looking back, there were bitter arguments about denominational fights. And this were quite drastic. And, you know, rather than calling us Catholics, we were known as Papists, which means followers of the Pope. So that was also one of those things. I'm not saying that he's wrong. I think somewhere in between, it could have been that as well. Yes.
But one aspect where I think the Portuguese culture actually has a sort of, that we can still see it today is really in the language, right? Many words in modern Malay actually come from Portuguese. You know, we have even from common words like major, bangku, and let's see, then there's mantega, for instance, for butter.
Sapatu,
that's right. So how did this sort of linguistic learning process happen?
Okay, I'm not a linguist per se, but generally, there is always an adoption, and if you have a better word and it's easier to say, generally it's adopted. I mean, now even sometimes certain Malay words are easier to use and more descriptive. So, you know, I think it lends itself to that way, and it also shows the influence of the Portuguese language. But actually, even if you go to Portugal now, and if you sit in the train and you see janela and you think, oh yeah, you know, that's a Malay word. Actually, it's not. You know,
it's a Portuguese word.
So obviously, these are what happens when there's an assimilation going on. Yes.
What do these words, especially the kinds of words that ended up being integrated into Malay, into our language, what does it say about the kind of communications that were happening about Malaysian history?
Actually, what everyone might be surprised to note that I think 16th, 17th century, the trade language was a kind of Portuguese Creole. And most people can speak. I think even in Malacca, if you, current day, if you go, the people who live near the Portuguese settlement, non-Eurasian, mm-hmm. non-Portuguese, the Chinese people, they can speak Kristang pretty well. Even the kids who play around there. So obviously, it's more like, you know, it rubs off on, right. on a person.
Yeah, yes. Malacca is quite different. It's very multicultural, multilingual kind of community that exists there. Maybe not so much these days, but I remember growing up, it used to be like that. We have a Chinese auntie who's living around the corner and she can speak Kristang.
Yes.
And an Indian auntie who will be speaking Chinese Hokkien to somebody else and all that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we don't see so much of this left in Malacca these days.
Mm. So it's interesting that you bring that up, Dennis, because one of the most important legacies of the Portuguese colonization is actually the Kristang community, which continues to have a presence in Malacca, has spread out over the rest of Malaysia as well. Sheila, could you explain, for those of us who may not know, what were the origins of this community during the Portuguese period? So first, the Kristang community refers to people of Portuguese and Malaysian descent. Am I correct?
It's an intermarriage of the Portuguese soldiers and traders that came
right.
and the locals. Mm-hmm. So that was how we came into being. I think even where Dennis is concerned, that's how we all came into being. And the development of it, if you're asking, is basically intermarrying, you know, through the centuries. Mm-hmm. And that's how, and I think culture and the king of Portugal at the time, they encouraged. So as I say, it's also always about the leaders. They encouraged the intermarriage and they accepted the offspring as their subjects. Mm. And I think that was one of the ways that it could carry on rather than other than disappearing. Sometimes some communities disappear because of being swallowed up by the more dominant community. Yes.
Yeah, I agree with Sheila because in those days, only men were allowed to sail on the ships. Mm-hmm. All right? So when they arrived at this part of the world, it could have been anything between 6 months later to 12 months later. And being all men in the ship, and you arrive here and you see Asian girls, I think they must have been salivating.
Ayo.
To put it crudely. But then, so they chased after the girls, like most men do.
It's getting a bit sexist. Yeah.
Thank you, Sheila.
It was a known fact.
I thought I should be a little neutral. Thank you.
So, some of them did start to have mistresses, and the church frowned upon it. And they say, well, you're not supposed to live in sin. If you like that girl, marry that girl. But first make her Christian. So that's what they did. They made her Christian. And the offsprings of this intermarriage came about the first Eurasians. As a matter of fact, Alfonso de Albuquerque himself actually encouraged the men to marry the locals. Mm. The reason for it, he found that the offsprings of these mixed marriages had very strong and interesting attributes. One is, they were staunch Christians. They were loyal to the king and country, although they have never even seen or been to the country that they serve. Thirdly, and most importantly, because they were not pure Europeans, they were half Asians, they did better in the tropical heat. So when the lazy Europeans were not working so hard, you could count on these people to serve the king and country.
Mm.
So that's okay, how we came about
Eurasians. I may not have put it quite so crudely, but, but yes, only men came out because it was a hard journey.
Sure.
It was not easy. If you think about how small the boats were, they were not beautiful big ships.
And it was a common, in terms of explorers and, you know, many of these colonizing nations were sending out men to most places anyway.
Yes.
But do you think, you know, to go back to that idea of intermarriage not being something that was frowned upon. Do you think there was an active push towards intermarriage?
There was an active, I think there was a decree by the king, because I think if you could settle your people in the colonies that you go to, you have a more settled group and not people who are going to move around so much and, you know, need to go back home to see wife or something like that, you know. Mm. That would have been not so settling for the trade or whatever, yes.
Right. So how has the Kristang community had an impact on Malaysian society?
Impact? I think whatever values they brought along with them has, I mean, impacted us even up to today. Although a lot of people forget, like a lot of the education from the mission schools and things like that.
The churches as well,
all
religion.
Have come to, you know, most people were educated by the missions. The first schools were brought in by all the Christian missionaries. Mm. They did not necessarily, they came to teach, and most of the early Malaysians were educated in a mission school. Mm. Yes.
Don't forget religion as well. St. Francis Xavier was here. It was a very important thing.
So yes. Portuguese Melaka, as we know, endured between 1511 to 1641. And we are still taught it as part of Malaysian history and so on, perhaps not to the depth that we should be taught. Why should we care about it today? Why is it something that we still need to study?
I think everyone needs to know their own narrative. And for a nation, we also need to know this is where we come from. There's nothing to be ashamed of anything. This is just who you are. So history is always important because it is his story, your story. You need to be able to tell your story. And also to remind everyone that, you know, it is also a very inspiring story. One of the smallest nations in the world, I mean, it's still very small, could actually send out people with the need to discover the age of discovery. So it is also for us today a lesson that even for us Eurasians as a very small group, it goes to show that we should be able to push ourselves forward. You do not need to have lots of people. You just need to have the will to want to do it.
Mm. Well, on that note, well, we do need to take a quick break. But when we come back, we will transition from talking about the Portuguese to bringing Dennis in a little bit more to the conversation, and we'll talk about the Dutch period of Malacca. You are listening to History on Repeat, and today I'm speaking with Sheila Da Costa, president of the Selangor and Federal Territory Eurasian Association, as well as Dennis DeWitt, independent historian. And we are talking about the Portuguese and Dutch legacies in the Malay Peninsula. We'll be back after a short break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to History on Repeat, the 8-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they matter today. So today I'm speaking with Sheila Da Costa, president of the Selangor and Federal Territory Eurasian Association, and independent historian Dennis DeWitt. We are talking about the Portuguese and Dutch legacies in the Malay Peninsula. Earlier before the break, we spoke about the Portuguese period of Malacca, and now we'll turn to the Dutch conquest of the city, which happened in the 17th century. Dennis, maybe we'll start at the beginning. How did the Portuguese lose Malacca to the Dutch? This was in 1641.
It was in 1641. Well, actually, the Dutch had already tried many times to capture Malacca, but they found a better place. It's called Batavia, mm-hmm. right? That's, of course, Jakarta today. And so the big question is, why did the Dutch still want to capture Malacca from the Portuguese? It was basically because of the early friendship that they had with the Malays in Johor. In 1602, a Dutch admiral sailed up the river and he met the Sultan of Johor. And it turns out that if you're the enemy of my enemy, then you're my friend. So after proving themselves to the Malays in Johor and signing a friendship agreement with them, they decided to work together. That's the reason why they tried to remove the Portuguese from Malacca, because Johor had seen the Portuguese in Malacca as a nuisance to them.
I think also that when the Malacca Sultanate fell, I think the descendants of the Malacca Sultanate went to Johor, so I think they were still a bit bitter. Mm. They possibly would have been a bit bitter there. And the Portuguese, from 1511 to actually the 1640, it didn't mean that they had a peaceful, happy time. Yes, there was always intrusions by the Dutch, by the Malays, by the Chinese, by everyone to try and dislodge them. Mm. So it was quite a busy time for them in that sense.
Yeah, for sure. So finally in 1640, I think there was an official request that was made by the Sultan of Johor towards Batavia to help to oust the Portuguese from Malacca. And this time there was a very strong backing from Johor that they will help the Dutch to do it. And Batavia arranged for a massive raid on Malacca. Mm. But the first raid, of course, when they landed, a lot of fighting, but the old fortress of Malacca was too strong. So therefore, they had to hold a siege against the town. And as you know, that siege lasted for 6 months or so. In fact, the anniversary of the siege, we had just passed it on the 14th of January.
That's right. Mm.
There were deaths on both sides. A lot of people died. There were records of Portuguese people in Malacca going up to the enemy, asking for help. There were also records to show that leniency was shown to some of the people, and they had moved out from the fortress of Malacca and gone away to this place called Melaka Pindah, or Malacca moved. Mm. That's what it means. So literally it means that the town of Malacca from the fortress moved out and settled down away from the town itself. So when the Dutch were laying siege on Malacca, their admirals and their commanders, many of them also died. I think there was one famous commander who was there. They were brought by the Dutch from the Spice Islands, and his name is Peter van den Broek. He's a well-known commander, actually. He's a well-known explorer because he was the first Dutchman to visit Mocha in the Middle East, and he brought coffee back to Europe. And that person died in Malacca. Okay? So finally, after that 6 month siege, there was one last raid on the fortress, and they managed to push through. And after pushing through, in a short while, they managed to capture the fortress. Mm. And when they captured the fortress, the Portuguese governor in Malacca surrendered the fortress to the Dutch. Now, in Karl Marx's book, Das Kapital, he actually mentions that the Portuguese governor of Malacca betrayed his people. And this was often quoted because the Portuguese, I think, they couldn't accept that the Dutch, being the enemy of the Catholics, could actually capture the fortress. It was just not possible, couldn't comprehend that God was not on their side. But in reality, looking at Dutch records, we realize that the Dutch saw the Portuguese governor as a formidable foe and gave him all due respect. In fact, when he passed away soon after the fortress was captured, they gave him a grand funeral. Mm. And of course, to the others, they would seem as if he had sold out the town. And instead, the Dutch had killed him. That was the story. But it was totally not true.
Mm. I'm just going to jump over to Sheila for a bit. What happened to members of the Portuguese community in Malacca after the fall of the city to the Dutch?
Okay, I've been thinking about this. And as is quite natural in this sort of thing, usually the richer ones have money, they can pay for boats and they can disappear. So I would have thought that even if you think today, this is what happens. And I've been thinking about it a lot lately, and I figured that, yes, that would have been it. So the people who could go would have gone much earlier. They wouldn't have waited for those 6 months. They would have, because a lot of starvation as well, they had no food and things like that. The ones left behind, me, would have either run into the jungle. Some of them went off to, I think you can find bits of them in Macau even, because they always say there's people from Malacca. So they would have, you know, gone away. And but there were many who also stayed and who were also left behind. I think ultimately a lot of them worked with the Dutch as well to in the administration.
Actually, from the records, from the Dutch records of Governor Balthazar Boort, who was governor in Malacca, he had stated down that after the siege, a group of Portuguese approached Dutch administrators and they said they wanted to leave. But the Dutch actually persuaded them to try and stay, you know. Mm. But they said, no, we wanted to leave. And so they were given a boat and they had taken their treasures with them and they'd gone back to India. So those who were left behind were basically those who couldn't afford or maybe not welcome, I'm not sure. Mm. So they were part of the Portuguese Eurasian community that was left behind in Malacca. And to the Dutch administration at that time, they actually encouraged them to be part of the community, because the Dutch knew that after so much devastation from the battle, where everything was practically lost, everything was practically destroyed, they need to rebuild the whole town. So they need to eye on communities to help them with the rebuilding of Malacca and the administration of the town. So for trade purposes, naturally, the Dutch were eyeing on the Chinese. If you bring the Chinese traders to Malacca, you can rejuvenate trade. If the Portuguese Eurasians are around, then those people will be able to help in the administration of the town.
Mm. Yes.
So how did the Dutch transform what was up till then a Portuguese city into a Dutch one over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries?
Malacca was basically rebuilt because after the battle in 1641, practically nothing was left. Even the fortress was so badly damaged that they had to rebuild the fortress.
Which is, we spoke about that earlier, yes?
Right? Yeah. So what you see in the town of Malacca and all those old streets, narrow streets in Malacca that everybody likes to go visit, especially Jonker Walk, essentially is from the Dutch era. It is built from about 1641 onwards.
Mm. And how did the Dutch become sort of that dominant European trading power, not just in Malacca, in maritime Southeast Asia at that time? What were some of the reasons that this happened and what was their interest in this region?
Oh, definitely trade. Because they didn't come, unlike the Portuguese, they didn't come as a nation. They came as a trading company, the VOC, right? So their main interest was trade. They were not really interested in religion as well. But they understand that to secure trade, you have to build up a network of friends in the region. So that's what they were trying to do. And I think that really helped because when the locals, the Malays, realized that they didn't come here to force their religion onto them, it worked for them as well.
Mm. Mm. So then how did the Dutch Eurasian community originate and develop? If it wasn't so much of a... Because it seems to me like from the Portuguese angle, there was that idea of church, the idea of the king actively promoting a certain idea. How did the Dutch Eurasian community begin?
Actually, that's a very interesting story. Because similarly, the Dutch sailors didn't bring their wives with them. But some of them did. Those who brought their wives were officials, higher-ranking officers in the company. So some of them brought their wives. They settled down here, especially after the expiration of their contract with the company. So they settled down here, and there's a very interesting concept because in those days, in the Dutch Eurasian community, there was an unspoken idea that they have. The men in the community were allowed to marry the locals, including the Portuguese Eurasians. But for the women of the Dutch community, their parents would prefer them to marry Europeans. So the whole idea of this was so that they would retain their identity and their culture. Mm. So there will always be a healthy mix of part European and part Asian as well.
And was there a difference in terms of the view of the Dutch community about intermarriage?
The 17th century records are a bit sketchy. They seem to have retained most of their marriages towards the Europeans. There were not complete records on who did the normal people marry. But for 18th century, there are some really very interesting records because what I found when I looked at the records from the Dutch Reformed Church in Malacca, I found the similar records in the St. Peter's Church marriages as well. So there were mixed marriages between the Dutch community and the Portuguese community that appeared in both churches. Mm. So they apparently got married twice. Mm. So that probably to officiate the marriage was the only way to do it was through the Dutch Reformed Church, but through a religious manner to the Catholic Church. And what I also found was, yeah, there were a lot of Dutch men who married Portuguese women and local women who became Christian. But they were also the other way around, you know. They were also Portuguese men who married Dutch women as well. If you look at the records, it actually shows a very interesting story. So what it shows here is that there is no split community. It wasn't just the Portuguese living by themselves and the Dutch living by themselves. Mm. They were all actually part of a greater community living in Malacca.
Mm. So what happened to the members of these communities, as you know, particularly at that point, I suppose, the Dutch community, when the 19th century came about and the city was transferred to the British?
When I look at the Dutch records in Malacca, I see almost an immediate change. When letters were written in Dutch before, with the coming of the British, immediately everybody spoke in English.
Mm.
Everybody was communicating with English. So that really helped. And I think it's true of the Eurasian community. We have basically learned to go with the flow.
Yes, we are very adaptive people and we can adapt. We could speak Portuguese then, we could speak Dutch. And a lot of us have our grandmothers speaking Malay, wearing the kebaya and the sarong as part of, you know, part of their daily clothing. Yes.
But Sheila, do you think that it could be the reason for our downfall as well? Maybe that's the reason why nobody knows about us.
Yes, and because numbers are small, and sometimes, I'm not saying this in any critical way, or maybe in a critical way, sometimes governments have their own agenda, and marginalizing people can be the result. So sometimes it's also about the people, that is us, that needs to put out our voice.
As you said, to tell your stories.
Yes.
Yeah, I totally agree because I think most Eurasians actually don't really tell about their own stories.
Yes.
That's why in Malaysia, we don't see the different communities. And most people, even Malaysians, think there are only Malays, Chinese and Indians in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much more here in Malaysia.
Yeah. Well, I do actually want to get to that. But before we do, I want to quickly wrap up this, specifically the Dutch history part. And what I would like to know is, what were the specific contributions from the Dutch Eurasian period, from the Dutch Eurasian community that we can still see today? What is the legacy?
Sometimes it's a bit difficult to find. But if you look closely enough, I think you might be able to see some things. People think that Portuguese are the only people who leave words behind in the Malay language.
That's not true.
But they're actually, yeah, they're Dutch words that are left behind in the Malay language. Words like laci, meaning drawer, comes from the Dutch word la. And chi basically means small drawer.
Mm-hmm.
Kamer, a room, is Dutch as well.
Ah, kamar.
Yes,
yeah.
Chamber.
Right.
Yes.
Right, chamber. And snaphan.
It's
actually snapang.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few words like this. But one other interesting thing that a lot of people actually don't realize is that, you know, the kuih kapit?
Yes. It's Dutch.
It's actually Dutch. Because in Malacca, we call it kuih blunder.
Yes, that's right. Oh, that makes sense. I didn't know it was called kuih blunder.
Although the name seemed to have been pushed back now. But yes, that was what it was. I think most of us growing up knew it as
kuih blunder. That's right. Yeah.
So it's actually an old form of waffles.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And even in the architecture as well, especially in Malacca, the way of how the buildings are built there are without foundations. They're clamped together.
Mm.
They're anchored together, just like the old Dutch buildings in Amsterdam or many parts of the Netherlands.
Mm. So now that we've sort of covered both of those aspects, and you also talked a little bit about how there were all of these connections between the Eurasian communities, after all of these years of historical change, migration, intermarriage, how culturally related are the various parts of the broader Eurasian community in Malaysia? Do you see yourself as being very similar? Are there many differences? How do we view them today?
Yeah, I feel that Eurasians are basically a huge community in Malaysia. I disagree with the fact that we should all be known as Portuguese Eurasian. To me, that's absolutely not true. There is no way a person like me with a Dutch surname can admit or say that I am a Portuguese Eurasian. I'm definitely Dutch descent. There are also communities of Dutch descendants from other parts, including from Ceylon, the Ceylon Dutch burghers who came to Malaysia. They have no connections with the Portuguese. There are also Dutch descendants from other parts of the archipelago, such as from Ternate, the Spice Islands, from Java. And there's even a Dutch descent family here who have their roots from Negapatnam in India. So they have no Portuguese connection. So I would prefer that we actually drop that Portuguese word and just call all Eurasians Eurasians. It's okay to have your own heritage. It's okay for you to be a Dutch descent. It's okay for you to be a Portuguese descent. It's okay for you to be a British descent. But we should all be collectively known as Malaysians and Eurasians. That's my opinion.
I completely agree. And with a Portuguese name, there is this. There are groups which want everyone to be known as Portuguese Eurasians and come. But as the leader of the Eurasians in Selangor, there are a lot of them who have absolutely no connection to Malacca or anywhere else. Like my mom, for instance, she's of third generation British descent, which we can trace. So they have what you call England, Scotland and Wales in their DNA. And they're not Catholics, neither they are Dutch Reformed. They're Anglicans, which is where the, British Church of England. So there are differences and everyone is proud of their difference. So I would like everyone to come under one umbrella rather than being known as a Portuguese Eurasian, because many of them have absolutely no connections. And if we want to be inclusive and if we want to take advantage of the wider group of Eurasians who have a lot to contribute, we must get away from this narrow definition. Yes, you can be of Dutch descent. I'm of Portuguese descent. I'm proud of it. You're proud of your Dutch descent. But, let's all get together because we are here together. So we need to work together to become at least to agree on who we are. And that is how you need to be inclusive.
Yeah, but I also think that it's easier said than done.
Yes.
Because
I agree.
Lot of minority communities out there, it's very difficult to come together and agree, come to a consensus.
Yeah. So on that note then, do you think that enough has been done to preserve the traditions and the memories of these Eurasian communities to educate Malaysians about the importance of, the Portuguese, the Dutch history in Malaysia? What more should be done?
There's a lot more that can be done, but there's also the problem of funding, which is something we don't really have. But we try our best to, whereas we in Kuala Lumpur, we try our best to try to promote in whatever way that we can. It's about telling your story many, many times over. Hopefully, it gets out there. Sometimes we appear in the papers, but I don't know whether anyone ever actually reads it anymore. But yes, I'm very interested in other people's narratives. So I'm very interested in the Dutch. I'm interested in the Portuguese. But I also like looking forward. I think there should be this moving forward to see how we all can work together. Not easy, I agree.
Yeah, it's not easy, but it shouldn't be about the funding, Sheila. I've managed to come up with a Malaysian Dutch Descendants Project, an initiative to actually tell the people that of the existence of the Dutch community in Malaysia. So I think by, first of all, being invited by BFM to talk about the Dutch, I think that initiative did actually work.
Yes, it does.
And it costs next to nothing, actually. Mm. It's only the participation of the community. So I don't know. I don't know whether the Eurasians can actually one day come together and agree that we are culturally
diverse,
but we also are connected to each other, and we should actually be more unified.
Does that responsibility, though, only lie with members of the community? Does there need to be more done? You know, I'm talking about in a government level. You know, is there more efforts that need to be done to be preserving these aspects of our history?
There needs to be obviously more work done, but it always the first step always starts with ourselves, doesn't it? That's what we are actually the Selangor Eurasians Association is actually celebrating its 100th anniversary. So we have been around for 100 years, even before other bits of Malaysia were even going. So we have been around a long time. Maybe sometimes in the way of things ebb and flow. So we need to push it up again, I think. Yes.
I think
what Dennis is doing is a great job, yes.
I think for Malaysians, I think they should stop looking at us as remnants of colonial powers.
Mm.
That's our history.
Yeah. Yes.
For good or for worse, history is history. You can't change it.
Yes.
So we exist. We did bring something to Malaysia. Mm-hmm. We celebrate ourselves as part of being quintessentially Malaysian.
Mm-hmm. 100% Malaysian, actually. There's not a lot of us around, but we are part of the fabric of Malaysia, and we should not be explaining when we go when you go to a hospital, how come you got foreign name, you foreigner. We're not a foreigner. We've been here half a millennia. That's a long, long time. We are part of this. We know exactly how everything works here. We are part of the, and we should be recognized and accepted rather than when you sit in a taxi, oh, you penjaja. We are not. We are Malaysians just like anybody else and deserve our place in the sun, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've got this funny story to tell you, actually. My daughter went to a clinic not so long ago, and she got a referral from the doctor. And when we look at the referral letter, race was written as Caucasian.
Oh.
Simply because the doctor did not recognize
because of her last name?
Yeah.
Mm. Even my dad, when he went to the government hospital, because he used to work. A lot of us contributed, our parents contributed by working in the government, helping the early days of Malaysia to develop. And he went to the hospital, and the doctor, and I'm talking someone who is well educated, uncle, you foreigner, how come you got blue IC? It's an insult, you know, really.
I think maybe classifying us as lain-lain, others, is also not very good.
Yes, lion is not a race.
Mm.
I think everybody would like to be known as something. Lion is not a something.
Yeah, it's no fun being known as the others.
Yeah.
Meaning don't care. Yes.
Well, on that note, hoping that perhaps there will be
someone who listens.
Yes. Thank you so much, Sheila, and thank you, Dennis. Really, I've learned a lot from talking to the both of you. Thank you for joining the show.
Thank you, Sharmila.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to History on Repeat, the 8-part mini-series where we think through key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and discuss why they still matter today. I've been speaking with Sheila Da Costa, President of the Selangor and Federal Territory Eurasian Association, and independent historian Dennis DeWitt about Portuguese and Dutch legacies in the Malay Peninsula. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous segments, you can download the podcasts on bfm.my, on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.